Turn again in your Bibles, please, to the book of Zephaniah, Old Testament prophet, minor prophet. And we read those verses again, verses 12 through 15. The Ethiopians also you shall be slain by my sword. And he will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria, and will make Nineveh a desolation and dry like the wilderness. And herds shall lie down in the midst, for all the beasts of the nations, both the pelican and the porcupine, shall lodge in the capitals thereof. Their voice shall sing in the windows. Desolation shall be in the thresholds, for he hath laid bare the cedar work. This is the joyous city that dwelt carelessly, that said in her heart, I am, and there is none besides me. How has she become a desolation, a place for beasts to lie down in? Everyone that passeth by her shall hiss and wag his hand. The Puritan Matthew Henry wrote rather succinctly and simply and rather shortly, the cup is going around. And of course, the cup that he has in mind is the cup of God's wrath. And it's a common image in the Old Testament, the cup of the wine of God's wrath that shall be drunk by the nations, and indeed by all who have departed from him. And so we're dealing with a passage of Scripture, as we've noted before, that has to do with judgment. Judgment for sin. And sin having to do with departing from God, more specifically with God's law and rebellion against it. At two levels, not only transgression, violating his law, and the Scriptures have much to say about that, and also in a different way, not approximating or fulfilling the positive commands of his law. And so he comes, strangely enough, interestingly enough, because we might think that God's people would be exempt for any number of reasons, but principally that they would be more honorable than the nations. And yet God begins with them and pronounces that judgment will fall upon them. And geographically, then, the nations that surrounded Jerusalem and Judah. And of course, what is prophesied actually took place, that the 10 northern tribes, remember there are 12 tribes, were taken captive by Assyria, the nation that is mentioned here, in 731 BC. And Judah and Jerusalem, later by Babylon, in 586. And yet this looks beyond those temporal judgments, because of the language that we have noted previously, especially in the latter part of chapter 1, that these temporal judgments point to that universal, worldwide judgment, universal judgment at the end of days. The Apostle Paul, citing from the Old Testament, says, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord." We look at a verse like that and we say, no vengeance for me, because there's no vengeance. Vengeance belongs to the Lord. But he goes on to say, but I will repay. And so geographically, we move from the west, the Philistines that were a plague upon Israel's life from time immemorial, it seems, And then to the east, to Moab and the Ammonites, who were related to the Jews. And then to the south, not just to Egypt, but rather to the southern part of Egypt, and that which is below even Ethiopia itself. And Ethiopia is often found in our English Bibles, but in Hebrew it's really Cush, or the Cushites, who are mentioned, and we'll come back to that in just a few moments. And so there are those who are close to Israel, or to Judah in this case, that are mentioned first, or at least second, Moab and Ammon. Greater accountability, because with greater knowledge comes greater accountability. But even those more removed and far removed are brought under the justice of God and the judging hand of God. No one escapes the eye of the Lord. His eyes are upon all. Sin and rebellion mark the nations of the world, and sadly, even the people of God. Especially pride, and we saw that previously in the last sermon with one of the tribes. And now it appears again as it relates to Assyria. And so Zephaniah, writing before the carrying into captivity of Jerusalem and Judah, announcing that it would come, but also announcing the destruction of those tribes surrounding Jerusalem and Judah. And very briefly, what we find throughout this passage, but especially in the verses before us, is that it's a passage that's marked to some degree by brevity. Zephaniah doesn't have to spend long hours debating or convincing. He merely makes the announcement, especially as it relates to the Cushites, one of the sons of Ham, mentioned in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 13, and also in Psalm 68 and verse 31. This sin and rebellion and the judgment that is to come, this announcement is marked by brevity. It's also marked by universality. And that's one of the things that we discover with the four points of the compass. No part of the world is accepted, not even remote Cush that is way down at the bottom of Egypt, hardly noticeable at all. Nations close and nations distant. Thirdly, it's marked by finality. As we'll notice as we come to the end of this portion of verse 15, there's nothing left of Assyria. It's met its judge and a final judgment or settlement. It's also, as we'll come to see, marked by agency, and the agency is God Himself. This is the Lord's doing. And we'll come back to that again, but we need to look at the events of human history and not merely say, well, they're the result of the action of this person or this nation or someone else, but rather they reflect the intervention of God always. And yet at the same time, in all of this, or I shouldn't say at the same time, but it's marked by successive progress that is victory, to put it, I suppose, rather simply and, I suppose, in a contemporary way, God wins. And He always wins. Well, let's come to the text then and just look at these few simple verses, verses 12 through 15, And notice the judgment of God on those so far away, you think God might not even notice. First of all, in verses 12 and 13, there is destruction. That God brings destruction. And notice, first of all, that it's personal. It's intentional. The passage begins in the second person. Ye Cushites, literally. Also, ye shall be slain by my sword. This is intentional. This is God acting. It's not fate. It's a summons. This is what's going to happen. God summons them to his seat of judgment. Not literally, but certainly metaphorically. And then he turns to the third person. And he will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria and will make Nineveh a desolation and dry like the wilderness. It's supernatural. It's intentional. Someone is acting. And the Babylonians aren't even mentioned here. Someone is acting. And the one truly acting is God himself. And it's supernatural. It's personal. It's intentional. And we discover who the person is. It's the Lord himself. My sword. My hand. This is not just the process of nations interacting with one another and tearing each other apart. Calvin writes, God calls whatever evils were impending over the Ethiopians his sword. For although they were destroyed by the Chaldeans, and by there he means the Babylonians, yet it was done under the guidance of God himself. The Chaldeans made war under his authority, as the Assyrians did, or as the Assyrians had, we might say, who had previously were employed by him to execute his vengeance. It's intentional, it's supernatural, and it's also moral. And I think our generation needs to hear that. That judgment is something that we ought to take seriously and never draw the conclusion that this is something that is, and we've said this before many times, but not just something that is Old Testament, reflecting an Old Testament God as if there are two gods, an Old Testament God and a New Testament God, and the Old Testament God is angry and the New Testament God is merciful, and we just don't want to talk about judgment at all. No, we need to talk about it. We need to think about it. God's eyes are upon everyone. And it's righteous. Fourthly, notice the imagery that is used. It's martial, meaning military imagery. The sword of the Lord. And who carries a sword but a soldier? Well, at least in the day. Now they're ceremonial, but in the day, soldiers carried them and soldiers used them. To the pain, even to the dismembering of their enemies. This is not sweet imagery. It's military imagery. And it's political. God uses the nations of the world. And we need to be very careful that we don't sit in judgment at times and say, well, this is what God is doing right now, because we really don't know. But when we look at the history of Israel, for example, we discover that because of Israel's sins, God sent the Assyrians. and they were taken into captivity. And then because of Judah's sins, now the nation had been divided by that time into really two nations, Israel and Judah, or Judah and Benjamin, as I've said. Then the Babylonians came along and destroyed Assyria and took Judah, Jerusalem and Judahites into captivity. And we can look back. Of course, we have an inspired record of God doing it. Now, there are a couple of reactions to that, reactions that we need to be aware of. One of those reactions is, well, God must be doing this in the world today, and God must be judging this nation or that nation. It seems to me that we need to be very careful and withhold our judgment at least a bit longer. We really don't know, except that God is alive and he's working among the nations. How is an altogether different question and doesn't always have an easy answer or solution. And one of the dangers we face is assuming that our nation, whatever that nation is, and of course I'm speaking to people who live here in the United States, conclude that when there is some struggle or some difficulty, it's always someone else's fault rather than ours. Now we need to be careful, because it's exactly what Assyria was doing here. Passing the buck, assuming someone else was responsible. And if God was involved at all, which I doubt if the Assyrians thought, because it's clear from this passage they weren't thinking that way. And yet God was bringing the hand of judgment upon them. There's another response that we need to be aware of and to avoid. And that is, and actually it's a question, or it's an approach that we find elsewhere in the prophets. And the approach is this: but that's not fair. So it's not fair that God uses the Babylonians against the Assyrians, or even worse, it's not fair when we come to 586 BC that God is using the Babylonians against his own people to chastise them and to bring judgment. And so we need to be careful that we don't define fairness in such a way as to lose the concept of justice and draw the conclusion that because we are his people, that we're scot-free, as it were, and no chastisement will ever fall upon us. But Matthew Henry, again, is right when he says Nebuchadnezzar was God's sword, the instrument in his hand with which these and other enemies were subdued and punished. And so God had something important to say to his own people ultimately. And he's saying it to his own people now in this book, because Zephaniah was a prophet related to the good king Josiah, or at least within that period. And so, again, here is destruction. And when it comes, it's the hand of the Lord. And God is the ruler among the nations. God rules. And we don't always know how, or we know how perhaps when what we see but what it is he's doing and who really is the target. And so there's destruction. Wilderness. It'll become a wilderness. And then secondly, there is devastation. And so this destruction is drawn out in terms of what it looks like and what happens and what falls upon the people. He will make Assyria a desolation and dry like the wilderness. And then in verse 14, and herds shall lie down in the midst of her. All the beasts of the nations, both the pelican and the porcupine, shall lodge in the capitals thereof. Their voice shall sing in the windows. Desolation shall be in the thresholds, for he hath laid bare the cedar work. Notice again, it's he hath laid bare. Cush is devastated, it becomes a wilderness. But when we come to the description of Assyria, Zephaniah breaks it down and draws attention to the specifics of this devastation that will hit the nation. And there are a number of things that are found here in this verse and a half. First of all, notice that the devastation is what we might call basic. It's total, it's comprehensive. And we've seen this before in other contexts as it relates to Jerusalem and Judah. But the devastation is wide-ranging, including both that which is general and large and that which is specific. The devastation is that it becomes a wilderness, again in verse 13. Secondly, notice that the devastation is diplomatic. It's political. It's civic. It has to do with the life of the citizenry. It's national as it affects the whole nation, but it's also specific as it affects the capital itself, which was Nineveh. So every part, it's total. It's comprehensive. And it has to do with political life. The political life of the nation is brought low and destroyed. Notice thirdly that the devastation is topographic. Even the land suffers. The environment is affected. The effects of God's judgment are environmental as well as international and political. Who is it that brings about tornadoes and storms? Where does the rising sea temperatures come from, whatever you may think of those things? They are occurring, so what do you make of it? Where does it come from? Well, we have all the pundits saying, well, it's man-made, it's we've done it, and we're involved in all that. That may be true at some level, but who is in control of nature? It's God himself. And notice that Assyria experienced the judgment of God that in part was environmental and ecological. Now before we start throwing bricks, or whatever it is we want to throw it at the various ones with whom we disagree, we need to think long and hard about the intervention of God, even in the world in which we live. And you see, we've lived in an age, in a period of time, in which science has become God, and medicine has become God, and all of these gods have taken from us a view of God at the center of the world in which we live, in the universe itself. This devastation was environmental, and it was brought on by God. Fourthly, the devastation was domestic, and by that I don't mean so much family difficulties, but rather it has to do with domestic life in that sense of economy and so forth. The livestock grazes where? The flocks and the herds, where are they grazing? They're grazing in the middle of a capital city. That would never have happened with kings upon the throne and all of the leaders of this. And it was a beautiful city, actually, they say. And it was very modern for its day. And the buildings were absolutely incredibly beautiful. It was a city to behold. And now, grass growing through the sidewalks, if in fact that's what they had, and animals living in the streets. Domesticated animals, they're no longer out in the fields where they had been and where they belong, but they're now in the midst of the city. And then the destruction is generic. Wild birds occupy, or wild animals, perhaps birds, probably birds, occupy the highest purchases. We really don't know what those birds are. The latest, actually for the last 200 years, and even going back to the Puritan era, were referred to as pelicans, and that's in my translation. And perhaps an owl, a certain kind of an owl, or even a porcupine. Calvin says, as to their various kinds, what he's about to say is, I don't know what these animals are, nobody else does. As to their various kinds, I make no laborious search, for it is enough to know the prophet's design. Besides, the Jews themselves, who boldly affirm that either the bittern or the stork is meant, yet adduce nothing that is certain. In other words, they're saying, this is what we think it is, but we really don't know. What, in short, this description means is, and here's the point, that the place which before a vast multitude of men inhabited would become so forsaken that wild beasts and nocturnal birds would be its only inhabitants. The capital of a building is the top part of a building, and so birds, and they're wild birds, are inhabiting, and perhaps other animals inhabiting, the capitals, the tops of the buildings, no one to shoo them away and to make use of those buildings. Sixthly, destruction is economic and very personal. Zephaniah says that desolation, the latter part of verse 14, shall be in the thresholds of a building. For he hath laid bare the cedar work, the fine appointing of these buildings. The grand homes and palaces are all gone, reduced to rubble. The inhabitants of animals, both wild and otherwise. The buildings and the future or furniture are gone. And therefore that in which the people boasted, their fine buildings and palaces, their own luxurious homes, there is now no place to boast. It's impossible. It's all been taken from them. In other words, there's no Hunts Point, if you know what that is, on the east side of Lake Washington, the place where all the wealthy, or many of them, have their palatial homes. And there's no Ethan Allen to buy the finest of all furnitures. All human achievement has been brought to an end by the sword of the Lord. And finally, then, the destruction is toxic. It's deadly. The city has been emptied of all people. Now, thirdly and finally, in verse 15, notice that there is a declaration, an announcement of what the people were, not just what they had, but the people were, and their degradation. This is the joyous city that dwelt carelessly, that said in her heart, I am and there is none beside me. Now is she become a desolation, a place for beasts to lie down in. Everyone that passeth by her shall hiss and wag his hand. What is it that can be said about Nineveh? This has so much relevance to the world in which we live here in North America. Notice, first of all, that Nineveh was joyful. There's nothing wrong with being full of joy and to be happy. But their joy was a carefree, comfortable, careless kind of joy. It was the chief object. And in the context, that's what this means. This is the joyous city that dwelt carelessly. They were amused. And amusement seemed to be the chief object of life. Secondly, Nineveh was casual or apathetic, indifferent to all things spiritual and holy. And of course, it was a pagan nation, but there's absolutely nothing here, and it's rather clear that there's nothing here about biblical faith and order at all. And so they were blinded by all of this splendor, their palatial homes, the palaces themselves, the flocks and the herds, and all that they had and all that they owned, and the nations that were now under their thumb. Nineveh was thoughtless with regard to spirituals, complacent. Externals were far more important to them than internals, meaning spiritual things. And prosperity meant that they must be doing something right. Thirdly, Nineveh was egotistical, audacious, arrogant, proud. We've seen this before with other tribes. Nineveh was defiant even toward its misfortune. Their I was a rival to everyone, including a rival to God. This is the joyous city that dwelt carelessly, that said in her heart, I am. What does that mean? I'm most important. You know, I'm on the top of the heap, at the top of the hill. Don't bother me. Don't challenge me. It's all about me. Any of this sound familiar? It's all about me. About nobody else. I'm all important. Comparing themselves to others. And their situation was fixed and it was perpetual. It would not change. There's no one like me. And God Himself could never even rival them. But what happened? All of that came to an end. All of it was brought to an end. And Nineveh became distasteful. Mocked. Contemptible. Repulsive. Abominable, if you will. How flourishing Nineveh had been. What great accomplishments she had made. The nation in the world. And the day came when people passing by would hiss and wave the hand in disrespect. Neighbors now looked upon them with contempt, whereas once they had looked upon them with admiration. Someone has written, God can, with His judgments, frighten the most secure, humble the most haughty, and mar the mirth, that is the happiness or joy, of those that most laugh now. This writer goes on to say, what little reason have men to be proud of stately buildings and rich furniture when they know not what all the pomp of them may come at last? And again he says, they shall not weep. Isn't that sad? All of this, but they shall not weep and wring their hands. The adversaries of those are unpitied and unlamented who were insolent and haughty in their prosperity. Or rather, what he means is that others will not weep over them, wring their hands in despair. But they shall hiss and wag their hands, forgetting. I think here's the key. Forgetting that perhaps their own ruin is not far off. Well, it's important that we are reminded by way of conclusion of significant themes that run through these verses that we've studied. First of all, remember that God is the Lord of all the earth. He's not just the Lord of one people or one nation, but He's actually the God over everyone, whether they recognize Him or not. Assyria held a typical worldview for the day, and it's a typical worldview for us today as well. Might makes right. Pleasure is everything. And wealth is the very best thing that we can gain or achieve. But all of that is false. And those who embrace such a worldview eventually are brought down. And God has a way of doing that. God has a way of doing that. History is in God's hands. History is divinely ordered. History is rooted in the sovereignty of God. And Nineveh's fall was such a fall from greatness and from a people so far remote from the center of religious faith, that no one gave it any thought at all. until it happened. Calvin writes, "What can be firm in this world? We see the principal seed of empire demolished and differing nothing from a desert." To put something a little bit differently than what I said previously, we need to come away from this text and draw this conclusion that the ruin of nations is less political and more supernatural than we are accustomed to thinking. And perhaps our own ruin, or at least we need to think of the possibility of our own ruin, is not far off. And if so, it will not be because one political party triumphs over another as much as we may have an interest in that, and a legitimate interest. It will be because God intervenes, and for His own purposes and His own reason. The present is no infallible guide to the future. And whatever we enjoy may be taken from us and could well be taken from us as a part of God's judgment. But there's hope. Now consider for a moment, why does all of this take place? Well, to be sure, the judge of all the earth will do right, because that's who he is. And he raises nations and he brings them down. But at the end of the day, what lies behind all of this as we take all of the prophets together? And that's the preservation, if we can come back to this morning, and the protection of his own people. He takes his people into captivity to chastise them, but also eventually to bring them out. And the nation that was their captor is destroyed, and they remain. And the same thing later with Judah, or with Jerusalem and Judah. Behind the work of God, we can discern a strategy. God does what he does to glorify himself and to secure the safety of his people. Assyria was destroyed. Israel remained. Babylon eventually was destroyed, and we're getting way ahead of ourselves. But God's people remain. And even the Psalms themselves, at least two of them, and we sung both of them this evening, call upon us not to trust in princes, in horses and chariots, or today we make it tanks and missiles and all sorts of things, but rather in the name of our God. And brothers and sisters, that's where our trust needs to be. Calvin wrote this, and I conclude with it, and it's from this passage. He says, the prophet mentions especially Nineveh, that the Jews might know that there is nothing so great and splendid in the world which God does not esteem of less consequence than the salvation of his church. So God threatens the wealthiest city that he might show how much he loved his chosen people. And the Jews could not have attributed this to their own worthiness, But the cause of so great a love depended on their gratuitous, meaning the result of grace, gratuitous adoption. And so we come in this context to the power of God exercised in and through the grace of God to save and to preserve the people of God. The very thing that we saw this morning in an altogether different context, in a New Testament context. God brings Assyria low, the nations low, in order that he might bless his covenant people. And we may thank God as we reflect upon our relationship to God that through covenant of redemption and the covenant of grace, that we by faith in Jesus Christ to become the people of God. Rejoice in him.